Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. Today's program is presented in celebration of National Library Week, April 10th through the 16th. National Library Week is a national observance, first sponsored in 1958 by the American Library Association and libraries across the country, as a time to celebrate the contributions of our nation's libraries and librarians to promote library use and support. This year's theme is Libraries Transform. We'll hear a talk by Wayne Wigand, renowned American library historian and author, often referred to as the Dean of American Library Historians. Dr. Wigand is the author of Irrepressible Reformer, a biography of Melville Dewey, published in 1996. His topic, which is the same as the title of his latest book, is Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. This program, co-sponsored by the Omaha Public Library, the UNO College of Education, and the UNO Department of English, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 23, 2015, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Charles Johanningsmeyer, Professor of English at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
It gives me great pleasure this evening to introduce Dr. Wayne Wigand, Professor Emeritus now of Library and Information Studies and of American Studies at Florida State University. He is, as our flyer indicates, truly the Dean of American Library History. In various positions over the years, he has been a leader in making the study of libraries in the past a serious endeavor, one worthy of both scholarly and institutional support. In his long and illustrious career, he has trained hundreds of excellent librarians, encouraged just as many scholars with their library history projects, and published a long list of well-regarded articles and books of his own. Indeed, one of his most enduring legacies, I would like to mention, is the Center for the History of Print Culture in Modern America, a joint venture of the Wisconsin Historical Society and the University of Wisconsin at Madison. The center, not the university, he co-founded when he was a professor at Madison, and he also ably served as its co-director for many years. I do not mean, though, to skip too quickly over Dr. Wigand's publications, which have been highly influential in the field. I personally, as someone with an interest in understanding how Americans interacted with books and magazines between 1870 and 1930, have found a good number of his scholarly articles and books immensely useful and enlightening. To name just a few of his most important and highly regarded monographs, I will mention Politics of an Emerging Profession, the American Library Association, 1876 to 1917. Another one, An Active Instrument for Propaganda, the American Public Library during World War I. Also, Irrepressible Reformer, a biographer of Melville Dewey. And Main Street Public Library, Community Places and Reading Spaces in the Rural Heartland. Indeed, it is thanks to Dr. Wigand's most recent book, Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library, released by Oxford University Press just last week, that we have him with us here tonight. To promote the book, Dr. Wigand has been speaking all over the country. For instance, in just the past 10 days, he has given presentations at the Library of Congress, the University of Maryland, Rutgers University, Columbia University, and the Kansas City Public Library. And from here, he heads to Salt Lake City and then on to Billings and Bozeman, Montana. In the midst of his busy schedule, Dr. Wigand has very graciously made time to come to UNO and give a presentation about what is an incredibly fascinating topic, one near and dear to all American readers, the American Public Library. You also might want to keep your eyes open for an upcoming release this fall of a major documentary film on the American Public Library for which Dr. Wigand served as the historical consultant. And I would like right now, actually, to take this opportunity to thank those who have made Dr. Wiggins' visit to Omaha possible. UNO's Department of English and College of Education, as well as the Omaha Public Library, generously provided financial support. But the person I would actually like to thank most heartily is Ms. Jody Durand, standing in the back. She is the Omaha Public Library's Community Engagement Manager. And from day one, when I mentioned to her the possibility of having Dr. Wiggins come to Omaha, she has just been incredibly enthusiastic about making this event available to both UNO and the local community, and has put in a great deal of time and energy to make it happen. And so please thank me and thanking not only Jody, but also our sponsors. So, okay. And now, I think this would be a good time for me to get out of the way and let you hear from the person you actually came to listen to. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Wayne Wiggins.
Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, Omaha, for having me. This was always my halfway point, sort of. When I was in college, I drove an Allied van line cross-country, and I'd get the shipments that started somewhere in Chicago and go out to San Francisco or Portland. And it was not a comfortable time for me. I made a lot of money in the summer. It carried my family over to Christmas time, but I was away from my wife and my children. So when I got to Omaha, when I got to Lincoln, when I got to Interstate 80, when I got along there, I knew I was about a day away from home. So Nebraska, Omaha, Lincoln makes me feel good. I've got a huge goal here today, to persuade you to broaden your thinking about libraries in general and public libraries in particular. I'm motivated in large part because of conclusions that emerged from research on this book that I've recently published, Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. My goal in that book was to find out historically why people love these ubiquitous civic institutions. And love them they do. A 2013 report by the Pew Research Center's Internet and American Life Project noted that in the previous decade, every other major institution, government, churches, banks, corporations, has fallen in public esteem except libraries, the military, and first responders. The study also found out that 91% of those surveyed over 16 years old said libraries are very or somewhat important to their communities, and 98% identified their public library experiences as very or mostly positive. Another Pew study found 94% of parents believe libraries are important for their children, 84% said because libraries develop a love of reading and books. In my historical narrative, I didn't take the conventional user in the life of the library approach. Rather, I took a library in the life of the user perspective because I wanted to trace the history of the public library not so much by analyzing the words of its founders and managers, but mostly by listening to the voices of the people who used them since the middle of the 19th century. Thus, instead of a top-down view, Part of Our Lives adopts a bottom-up perspective that features the voices of generations of public library users. Largely because of recent technologies, uncovering many of these voices was not difficult. Time-consuming, yes, but not difficult. Some are published in memoirs, autobiographies, and biographies of the famous, some in manuscript collections and public library archives across the country. The vast majority, however, are fixed in thousands of U.S. newspapers and periodicals digitized since the 1990s into huge databases. By using public library as a search term, I found thousands of voices in letters to the editor, thousands more quoted in stories reporters wrote about their local libraries. As I analyzed this data, I was surprised at how quickly it organized into three main categories, and in no particular order, I list them for you. For the useful information they made accessible, for the public spaces they provided, and for the transformative potential of commonplace stories they circulated that helped users make sense of their worlds. First, a few historical examples that comfortably fit the category of information as we currently define it in librarianship. While sitting at a Cincinnati public library desk in 1867, Thomas Edison compiled a bibliography on electricity. A colleague later recalled, "Many times Edison would get excused from duty under pretense of being too sick to work and invariably strike a beeline for the library, where he'd spend the entire day and evening reading such works on electricity as were to be had." In 1899, Wilburn Orville Wright came upon an ornithology book in the Dayton Public Library that rekindled their interest in human flight, one of their biographers writes. "By the time I was 12 or 14, Harry Truman recalled, I had read every book in the Independence Public Library, including the encyclopedias. Those books had a great influence on me." In a Detroit public library reading room in the 1950s, a teenage female pored over comedians' printed monologues. She appeared in short monodramas written by herself without makeup and hardly any props, Lily Tomlin's biographer later noted, conjuring up not only the personality of the character she portrayed, but also that of unseen people with whom she was talking. About the same time in Hot Springs, Arkansas, 10-year-old William Jefferson Clinton discovered the Garland County Public Library. "I'd go there for hours, browsing among the books, especially those on Native Americans," which may explain the shirt he's wearing. In 1971, 10-year-old Barack Obama returned to Honolulu from Jakarta. "The first place I wanted to be was the library," he later recalled. Often he had a specific information need. "One Saturday, with the help of a raspy-voiced old librarian who appreciated my seriousness, I found a book on East Africa. Obama wanted information about Kenya, birthplace of his father, a Luo tribe member. The Luo raised cattle and lived in mud huts and ate cornmeal and yams and something called millet," the book said. "Their traditional costume was a leather thong across the crotch." Shocked by what he read, Obama left the book open-faced on a table and walked out without thanking the librarian. All these people had information needs an American public library met, and the anecdotes I've read fit nicely into the traditional discourse of librarianship that focuses primarily on information. In many respects, a professional discourse functions like a big intellectual sandbox. Plenty of room to play with ideas, but one nonetheless with limits, a social boundary, if you will, in which the profession's leaders employ a formal way of thinking to educate and enlighten members who then implement what they learn to improve professional service for the public's greater benefit. For librarians, that translates into services they institute and maintain and collections, spaces, and resources they make accessible. For most of its history, librarianship's discourse has focused on what in the 18th and 19th century was called useful knowledge, in the 19th and 20th century was called best reading, and in fact, the American Library Association's official model still has that phrase in it, the best reading for the greatest number at the least cost. And in the late 20th has morphed into information. This focused term gives particular meaning to the phrase access to information that to this day dominates the profession's thinking and automatically imposes boundaries on its intellectual sandbox. But the American Public Library is a unique civic institution because, unlike most other civic institutions like courts and schools, people don't have to use it. As a result, over the generations, users heavily influenced the process of shaping library collections and services. Librarianship's discourse, however, does not address in any direct way this kind of bottom-up pressure, and for me was not comprehensive enough to explain what I was discovering about the library as a place and the transformative power of stories users withdrew from libraries over the generations. So to explain my findings, my challenge became how to expand beyond the professional discourse, how to see outside the boundaries of librarianship's limited sandbox of ideas, how to craft a framework that accommodated and explained the voices of library users I was uncovering in my research. To illustrate the importance of library as place, let me introduce you to Ricky. This, by the way, I have three trailers in my PowerPoint, and all of them come from this forthcoming documentary on the American Public Library. Now, Chuck said it was going to come out in the fall. Actually, they scored a major grant, which is going to allow them to polish it in 2016, and they hope to issue the documentary by Sundance Film Festival in 2017. You wonder why they want that? Okay, here we go. Rick, this is Ricky.
My name is Ricky Powers. I live in San Francisco, and I've been here for about a decade, and I'm currently unemployed, but I do go to school. My apartment is about this big, and I don't have any room for a desk, and so I come to the library to do my homework, but it's also just a great resource. I like to come to the gallery and see what shows they have going on. I come to lectures, I come and see films that they do. Mayoral debates, I've been here for a couple of those as well. Well, the reason that I'm here is because I think it's just important for people to understand. So when I first moved to San Francisco, I told you I went broke, and I was literally starving. And I had a place to live, but the library kept me warm, and it did. I'll get it together here in a second. There was a truck that came outside once a week, and I could go and get food there. And like I said, they have computers so that I could work on my resume and I could apply for jobs. And did I mention that it was warm here? So it's been there for me when I needed it. And it's a valuable resource. And oftentimes I think that people see the library as someplace for kids or someplace for homeless people. And there are just normal people like me that might need it as a resource. And I'm grateful that it's here.
Okay, and from my narrative, I quote a few more anecdotes. During the summer of 1939 at Atlanta Public Library's African American branch, one of the few places in the city where blacks felt safe and welcome, 10-year-old Martin Luther King Jr. came to the library many times during the week, Director Annie Waters later recalled. He walked up to the desk and looked me straight in the eye. "Hello, Martin Luther," she would respond, always calling him by his first and middle name. "What's on your mind?" "Oh, nothing particularly." For Waters, that was the cue that King had learned a new big word, and they then initiated a conversation in which King used the word repeatedly. Another game involved poetry. Again, King would stand by the desk waiting. "What's on your mind, Martin Luther?" Waters would ask. "For I dipped into the future far as the human eye could see," he responded. Waters immediately recognized the poem and finished the verse, saw a vision of the world and all the wonder that would be. When the Cincinnati Public Library opened a piano room in 1955, among its first visitors was 12-year-old Jimmy Levine as he scratched his name in pencil on the room's sign-up sheet. 8 visits later, he changed his signature to J. Levine and finally James Levine. When he gave a concert for 150 children in the children's room in 1957, he'd already performed as a Cincinnati Symphony soloist. Today, he's the New York Mets artistic director. In 1969, the Gary, Indiana Public Library sponsored a local talent contest at which a group soon to be known as the Jackson Five competed. Although they didn't win, little Michael was an audience favorite. In 2005, the Washington Post carried an article by Eric Wee that focused on a District of Columbia branch library in one of Washington's poorest neighborhoods. In it, Wee reported that every Tuesday night, a homeless man named Conrad Cheek entered the library and set up his chessboard on one of the tables in the children's room. Wee immediately noticed the transformation taking place. No more ignored pleas for this homeless man, no averted glances. During the next hour, people will look him in the eye. They'll listen to his words. In this down-at-the-heels library, he's the teacher. Among his students was 9-year-old Allie Osman. As we watched this interaction, Allie's mother explained that her son's confidence had soared after playing with Conrad. that he was now bragging to friends about being a chess player. "We owe it all to Mr. Conrad," his mother said. "We love him." Inside the library, we reported, they call him Mr. Conrad. I'm going to give you a few examples of library as place in the Omaha Public Library history. For example, in 1922, Omaha vagrants agreed to spend 10 days in the public library in lieu of 10-day jail sentences. Some judge must have figured out that was a good thing to do. All right. In public schools located in the center of Omaha's Packing House and Stockyards District in the 1910s, where almost every European nationality is represented besides the Mexicans and the Negroes, groups of students made regular visits to the Omaha Public Library for information to supplement their curriculum. To assist the library in selection, 15-year-old Louis Diamantis, a Greek immigrant who came to the U.S. 5 years earlier speaking no English, became a regular user. Now his English is excellent, the Christian Science Monitor reported, and he has acquired a variety of education that could not have been possible without outside reading. 1940s, the Omaha Public Library hosted babysitting clinics for children 11 and older. Notice all these very meaningful experiences occurred in a place we call library. To categorize them as information gathering fails to capture their significance in the lives of each of these individuals. My analysis of library as place grows out of a scholarly literature often labeled public sphere, a rich repository of ideas that can deepen our understanding of the multiple reasons why people love their public libraries as community places. Now let me turn to the transformative power of commonplace stories public libraries have circulated by the billions for generations. Meet Maria.
My birthday was yesterday, and I am 95 years old. I started to use the library, I would consider 12, 13 years old, you know. Yes. I was born in St. Petersburg, Russia. We left and we started from scratch. And my English was zero, but their library was a couple of blocks away. And that's how it started. That library was everything to me. We could not afford to buy the books. Books were always expensive, and there were so many other needs. It was library, library, library all the time. And it didn't cost anything. Well, the library fills a certain place in my life. Certain has to satisfy certain needs. I have seen a lot of very ugly things. And you just can't live all the time with bad. You have to balance it. And my balance was mostly to see something beautiful. And so I would go to the library and spend a couple of hours. But when I come out on the street, I'm a completely different person. It gave me such a relief, as French would say, soulagement, you know.
And more from my narrative. In a 2008 interview, 88-year-old Pete Seeger recalled an early life reading experience. At age 7, a librarian recommended me a book about a teenager who runs away from his stepfather, who's beating him and is adopted by a middle-aged Indian whose tribe was massacred and whose wife was sold into slavery and is living alone. That Seeger remembered this so vividly 80 years after reading it is testimony to the power of stories, and in Seeger's case, a New York Times editor noted upon his recent death, fitting for someone who went on to engage issues of conscience. In 1984, President Ronald Reagan wrote the daughter-in-law of Harold Bell Wright, whose best-selling 1920s religious novel, That Printer of Udell's, Reagan read as an adolescent in Dixon, Illinois. Wright was no favorite of contemporary literary critics. H.L. Mencken called him a liberated yokel from the cow and hog states. Another critic was equally harsh. Harold Bell Wright supplies more negative data on the literary quality of the taste of the fiction-reading public than any other author. No matter to young Reagan, however. Shortly after reading the book, he declared himself saved and was baptized. The novel's protagonist, Reagan wrote Wright's daughter-in-law 60 years later, served as a role model that shaped his life ever since. It's highly likely the copy of that printer of Udell's Reagan Read came from the Dixon Public Library, which he visited twice a week in the early 1920s, mostly to check out Frank Merriwell's stories, Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan novels, and books by Horatio Alger, Zane Grey, and Mark Twain, many of which he read on the library's front steps. "I'm a sucker for hero worship," he later admitted. For Oprah Winfrey, reading commonplace stories was an open door for freedom in my life and allowed me to see that there was a world beyond my grandmother's front porch in Mississippi, that everybody didn't have an outhouse, and that everybody wasn't surrounded by poverty, that there was a hopeful world out there, and that it could belong to me. To Winfrey, the stories became her comfort, her solace, to commune with and learn something about myself, to learn something about other people, to learn something about the world. In a small Milwaukee apartment as a 9-year-old in 1963, she read a public library copy of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Her first all-night book, the story of Francie Nolan, whose life was full of humiliation and whose only friends were in books lining the public library shelves. I felt like my life was hers. After her father died in 1963, 9-year-old Sonia Sotomayor buried herself in reading at her Bronx library and the apartment she shared with her mother and brother. Nancy Drew had a powerful hold on my imagination, she remembered. Every night, when I'd finished reading and got into bed and closed my eyes, I'd continue the story with me in Nancy's shoes until I fell asleep. Her mind, she noted, worked in ways very similar to Nancy's. I was a keen observer and listener. I picked up on clues. I figured things out logically, and I enjoyed puzzles. I loved the clear, focused feeling that came when I concentrated on solving a problem and everything else faded out. Her reading that summer, she admitted, was her solace and only distraction that got her through this time of trouble. More examples from the Omaha Public Library. Big controversy in the late 19th century when many librarians didn't want any fiction at all in the library, and the Omaha Public Library withdrew some of its own. Well, the Omaha world argued against it. People like that were merely literary snobs who desire to force others to comply with their standards. The gray-haired men of today who read the stories of Harry Castleman and Horatio Alger years ago will readily testify that they had not only derived pleasure from reading them, but that they were helped to better living. In the Omaha Public Library Children's Room in 1896, young patrons contrasted assigned reading in school with open access to books they found there. They half fancy that it's through their own efforts that they choose from the loaded shelves of books those which it will be the most fun to read. The librarian told an Omaha World Herald reporter, "There's something in letting readers find their own books. There is that sense of having found something good himself, which appeals to the child as freedom is blessed to the man and the woman of later years." All these anecdotes point to the power of printed commonplace stories to change people's lives. But stories reside in all cultural media. If you watch television, go to the movies, read popular magazines, look at advertisements, argues Richard Keller Simon, you're exposed to many of the same kinds of stories as someone who studies the great books of Western civilization. You've simply been encouraged to look at them differently. Stories, Richard Nash argues, constitute recipes for the imagination. Media scholar Henry Jenkins adds, stories are basic to all human cultures. The primary means by which we structure, share, and make sense of our common experience. Meet Danny.
One of the things that, say, the library offered me was that it was a place where I could actually absorb American pop culture. I grew up in an immigrant household, so I always, like, the library for me was always the place where I can get free media. When I was a teenager, I was, like, really big into, like, punk rock culture and the music scene. So, and I couldn't afford records, so I was always going to the library, whereas my friends were able to either buy their records with their parents' money or worse yet, steal it. I would always go to the library and check them out. When I was a teenager, I think I might have been, like, 15 years old, I had heard about a film called A Beautiful Thing, which is based on a play, and it's a gay film. I remember going to the library and looking up in the catalog and, like, making sure, like, nobody saw me, and I would go, I went to the stacks, I found it, I kind of hid it underneath, like, a stack of books, like, sandwiched between and a stack of books, and I checked it out. I took this video home, I had to hide it from my parents, and I remember watching this film, and it was so powerful to me. It was a love story between two young British teenagers. And for me, it dropped a certain anchor down where, on an emotional level, I didn't feel like I was floundering somehow. So that felt really good. And I remember playing that cassette tape, that VHS tape, over and over and over again, late at night when everyone in my house was sleeping. I would sneak out to the living room and I would play this video that I had borrowed from the library, like, at least once a night for 3 weeks in a row, sometimes repeating certain scenes over and over again, just because for me they really spoke to me. And then I would renew it.
That public libraries have always played a primary role in making stories accessible to millions of users is obvious. Ever since the Boston Public Library opened in 1854, fiction, a particular story form, consistently averaged 66 to 75% of public library circulation. By force of demand, then, every generation of public library users has insisted on a set of stories acceptable to a majority of community members that contained messages they wanted to hear, read, and view. The latest public library circulation statistics I'll detail in a minute show they still do. History of reading scholars have clearly demonstrated the capacity of commonplace stories to stimulate reader imagination, construct community through shared meaning, and demonstrate moral achievement. In the free will act of reading, they note, readers move into and out of a text and thus appropriate meaning relevant to their own lives. Because readers can control it, the act of reading stories becomes dependably pleasurable, empowering, intellectually stimulating, and socially bonding. And it's in the act of reading stories that social and cultural acts of defiance takes place. If cultural authorities lack the power to check voluntary reading for interpretations legitimized by dominant cultures, ordinary readers construct their own meanings, sometimes as groups, sometimes as individuals. Most often, public libraries do a good job of democratizing their spaces and supplying information and stories, as is evident from Seeger's, Reagan's, and Winfrey's remarks. Sometimes, however, they don't. You see here two beefy white cops taking a skinny African-American teenager out of the Albany, Georgia Public Library in July of 1962, at which time most public libraries in the South were segregated. It wasn't until about the 1967-68 that the last one was taken care of. Or the pulps that paperback titles from the 1960s and 1950s and 60s that many gays and lesbians read voraciously and considered survival literature were never reviewed in Booklist magazine, listed in fiction catalog, or acquired by public libraries. What public libraries often gave them instead was misinformation. Because she believed libraries are places where we can be most anonymous and delve deeply into areas we wish to uncover in secret, one 15-year-old later recalled, it was to the library I turned in 1969 to uncover the meaning of my lesbianism. And what I found was not echoic of my own experience. Rather, those books frightened me and convinced me that this was not lesbianism I was experiencing, but something else. A couple of incidents from the Omaha Public Library. In 1902, the Omaha Public Library barred Huckleberry Finn from their collections in response to a local protest. Namby-pamby public library boards, protested the Omaha World Herald. The expert guardianship of the reading education of the boy is becoming monotonous. We don't believe the boy lives who would not have his mind quickened and stimulated by the reading of books like for boys like Oliver Optic, Horatio Alger, even Harry Castleman's thrilling stories of the plains. Of course, you knew Mark Twain had to get involved with that, too. I am tearfully afraid this noise is doing much harm, Twain wrote the Omaha World Herald. It has started a number of hitherto spotless people to reading Huck Finn out of a natural human curiosity to learn what this is all about, people whose morals will go to wreck and ruin right now. But then there's the incident in the 1970s when the Nebraska Library Commission through the Nebraska Library Commission, the Parents and Friends of Lesbian and Gay Cornhusker Incorporated distributed 8 book sets on AIDS and gay issues to 68 public libraries. Accurate information is essential to combat prejudice, the group's president told the Omaha World Record. And then there's that serial fiction I told you about, Sonia Sotomayor reading Nancy Drew. She couldn't get it at the New York Public Library because the librarians there considered it trash. It wasn't until 1976 that the New York Public Library began acquiring series fiction and romance readers. When an Omaha World Herald columnist questioned the value of romances in the Omaha Public Library in 1996, readers fired back. I love romance because I can relate to the heroines, unlike the images portrayed in women's magazines and most movies, said one. Said another, romance is empowering and it's uplifting. It makes us like women and expect more from men. Oops, maybe I've hit on the reason it's so maligned. By far the better question, a third said, is why alone among all readers of commercial fiction are those who read romances constantly challenged by such as you to defend their preference? Remember back in the 1980s when many evangelists of information technology predicted the demise of public libraries by the turn of the century? They were wrong, dead wrong. In 2012, the latest year for which we have statistics, the U.S. had more public libraries than ever, 17,219, including branches and bookmobiles. That's more than 3,000 more than McDonald's restaurants in the United States. While the number of visits declined slightly in 2012 from 1.52 to 1.5 billion, and I remind you the recession forced libraries to reduce hours by 2% nationwide and that more patrons were downloading library e-books from home computers, the decade nonetheless showed a 21% increase. That same year, 93 million Americans attended a public library program, a one-year increase of 4%, an eight-year increase of 38%. 65 million attendees were children, a nearly 4% increase from the previous year, and a 24% increase from the previous decade. In 2012, public libraries circulated 2.2 billion items, including audio and video materials and e-books, a 28% increase from 2003. Circulation per capita showed a 10-year increase of 17%. Public libraries also provided users with access to 250,000 internet-ready computers, 100% more per capita than a decade earlier. For generations now, library and government officials have argued that the public library's most important role is to provide access to useful information that develops intelligent consumers, creative entrepreneurs, and informed citizens. the kind of information Thomas Edison pursued in his public library that many argue people can now retrieve on their computers at home. Public library users, however, show a different set of priorities. For them, the tens of thousands of spaces public libraries provide for many purposes and the billions of commonplace stories they circulate in a variety of textual forms are at least as important as, perhaps even more important than, access to information, and for a variety of reasons. In her book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier, Happier, and Smarter, published just last year, Susan Pinker harnesses research in the fast-developing field of social neuroscience to demonstrate that substantial benefits accrue to those who experience high levels of face-to-face contact, including improved vocabularies, an increased ability to empathize, a deeper sense of belonging, and, perhaps most important, a longer lifespan. Neuroscientific research that focuses specifically on the social nature of commonplace reading comes to similar conclusions. Fiction, notes research psychologist Keith Oatley, is a particularly useful simulation because negotiating the social world effectively is extremely tricky, requiring us to weigh up myriad interacting instances of cause and effect. Just as computer simulations can help us get to grips with complex scientific problems, so novels, stories, and dramas can help us understand the complexities of social life. As I pondered these conclusions from the field of social neuroscience, I wondered if face-to-face contact American public libraries make possible in so many ways enables users to live longer, happier, and healthier lives than non-users. This is a researchable question. Anybody out there want to take it on? I encourage you to do so. And if they do so, why? Answering that question requires us to expand way beyond the traditional focus of librarianship on information access in order to explore the community building and personal benefits of public library as place and the sociability that reading, viewing, and listening fosters. In my lifetime of research into American library history, I've read thousands of statements like, "Public libraries are not just warehouses of books anymore." If part of our lives accurately represents public library history, they never were. Yet, for effect and contrast, journalists often parroted and reinforced this myth by drawing on these stereotypes and on their own limited public library experiences. If I had a dollar for every time I came across this kind of statement in my research, I'd probably make more than the royalties this book will generate. I've also read hundreds of sweeping predictions concerning the future of these ubiquitous institutions. Of those grounded largely on a particular definition of useful knowledge in the 18th and 19th century, on best reading in the 19th and 20th century, and on information in the 20th and 21st century, of those that ignored the power of library-supplied stories millions now read, view, and listen to daily, and the library is place billions now visit annually, none prove true. I urge you all to keep that in mind as you ponder today's predictions about and plans for tomorrow's public library. Access to information, library as place, and the transformative potential of reading commonplace stories. I hope conclusions I've drawn from my historical research have persuaded you to broaden your thinking about libraries in general and public libraries in particular. The naysayers, largely ignorant of this library history, are still with us. "It's all on the internet," hype many evangelists of information technology. "Libraries are dinosaurs," grouse officials looking to cut budgets. I argue here that to combat this limited thinking, we have to extend our scope beyond information access to include, from a user's perspective, deeper analysis of library as place and the role of commonplace stories. This is the lobby of the Toledo Lucas County Public Library the night that a Harry Potter novel was released. Run your eyes across the people there and see the diversity of this population. Gender, age, race, ethnicity. And then ask yourself, on that night when these people got together, what happened in so many ways? Or here's your awe moment. This is my son Andy reading to my grandson Teague. Teague selected that book from the library and is fully capable of reading it, but he wanted his dad to read it to him. I wished I had a picture of me reading to Andy to put next to that book. I couldn't find any in the family archive. At any rate, that dynamic represents an experience that I'm guessing most of you have had in this room. And I would argue maybe that dynamic, I would suggest, if my reading of history is any indication, maybe that dynamic has more to do with increasing literacy than the mechanics of formal education, No Child Left Behind, and Common Core curricula. We haven't researched it. There are no longitudinal studies to give us indications of this. We have some studies to indicate that summer reading programs in public libraries deposit children in the subsequent year at the same level of reading that they were left in the previous year. We've got to do more of that in order to understand the value of public libraries. Okay, by looking at questions like these, my historical research demonstrates, we can document hundreds, if not thousands, more ways these incubators of personal happiness and informal self-education contribute to the daily lives of our patrons as individuals and as members of their community, and we can show much more clearly how they function as active and effective agents in the construction of that very community. Thank you very much.
We have a few moments for questions. If you'd like to ask, I can bring the microphone around. You might have a question for Dr. Wigan.
I must have offended somebody.
What made you want to start researching the history of libraries?
When I got out of graduate school with a PhD in history, there were no jobs. As an undergraduate, I met a guy who was both a PhD in history and a librarian at a small college, Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, which was near my hometown. And I thought, boy, that's kind of neat. So I sort of aimed in that direction, but then I realized I loved research and writing so much that I've told folks I had dinner with, people who run libraries are special people. I ain't one of those. So I do the research and the writing. I didn't enjoy the running of a library as much as I did the research and writing. But for a historian, golly, this 17,219 public library outlets in this country and how little they've been studied historically, yet I've just given you a sample of the famous people who've used them and benefited from them. The original manuscript, the mind dump stage, when you get all your data together and you write that first draft, was 500,000 words. The book you find outside is 135,000 words. There are 365,000 words of these kinds of anecdotes that somebody else should be doing something with besides me. There they are for you.
Out of the 17,000-plus libraries, how many are Carnegie libraries?
Oh.
And how did they come about? I grew up in one in Council Bluffs.
I can't tell you how many still exist because a number of them have been raised. A number of them have been made into city halls in local small towns. There's one in Huntington, West Virginia, that's my favorite, was turned into a bar, and the circulation desk is... So I like that one. But he put up about 1,600 public libraries in the United States. More important than that, though, it stimulated other philanthropists to give. And so in a lot of smaller communities, or larger communities, I mean, the Enoch Pratt Free Public Library in Baltimore, Maryland is an example of that. And the New York Public Library came out of that kind of a giving atmosphere. So, one thing that people have not recognized, When Council Bluffs submitted a grant proposal, not like we do today, but it was simply a letter from a group of people in Council Bluffs, of this I am certain, saying, we need a new library. Well, it would be turned over to this grumpy secretary that Carnegie had, and he would check the population, and he checked to see if there was a social library that existed, and then he would, according to a formula, say, you get $20,000 or $25,000 for your building. And then usually the people would respond, well, we've never built a library before. You got any suggestions? And so the grumpy secretary had six architectural plans drawn up. That's one of the reasons Carnegie libraries look so similar, because of these six architectural plans. But in every single one of those architectural plans, there's substantial space for what was called a community room. And I'll bet your Council Bluffs library had one. Now, my guess is, at some time, those Council Bluff librarians did their job so well, they acquired amassed large book collections, and then they moved some of that into the community room and eliminated it as space. We are beginning to rediscover that as an essential component of library service. Space.
Yes, I would like to hear a little bit more about the movie that's coming out. Can you tell us about that?
Oh,
please.
Yeah, the two San Francisco filmmakers are Don Logsdon and Lucy Faulkner. Now, Don and Lucy have worked together on a film that you can see. It's called Tremé. It's about an African-American neighborhood in New Orleans. They were working on it and thought they had finished it, and Katrina came through. And then they went back to look at that neighborhood. And so their documentary, they thought they had finished it, but they had to take another 2 years to finish it, which is why they were delayed on the public library documentary. Every once in a while, they send me a note saying, you sure Ken Burns hasn't found out about this? I mean, national parks, wonderful. But the American Public Library is a ubiquitous civic institution. And to overlook that, they're worried that shortly after the book was released, some media person got in touch with me and said, would you sign over movie rights? I can't imagine a movie will ever come out of this. So I told Dawn and Lucy, I'm asked to sign this, and I have to do it by contractual obligation to OU, but I'm turning it over to Oxford University Press. And they immediately came back and said, you sure Ken Burns isn't behind this? So it is being worked on. And if I was successful in doing anything, it's that I think they're using the library in the life of the user perspective, rather than the user in the life of the library perspective. You see it in my three trailers, the trailers that they gave to me. They're talking to library users. Now, that doesn't mean they aren't talking to librarians also, but that emphasis will be in that documentary. Yes?
Based on your research, do you think that libraries will ever be taken over by technology, or do you think they'll always be a part of society?
One of the things the book documents is change and continuity. The change is forced by newer technologies. The continuity is in the stories and the place. Okay? I have confidence. I'm a historian. I reek of archives dust. I'm a lousy person to ask about predictions. I will say, however, that as you librarians of the Omaha area plan the future, don't forget the history, because it ain't all going to be on the internet. And don't forget Conrad Cheek, and don't forget Ricky. They're there in the libraries. And what libraries do for those people is an extremely valuable thing for which we haven't taken enough credit. In part because we don't have the research among things I hope this does for you, this book, is gives you a vocabulary to explain emotional attachments to public libraries. I can do that historically. I can pull the record out of history. What I don't do it is contemporaneously. And I think that has every indication about directions one ought to be thinking about taking in the future. New York Public Library, for example, banked on everything being digital. I don't know if you read about the big controversy there, but they got stopped in their tracks. People came out of the woodwork and said, you are not doing this to our library. And those are really powerful people.
Did the concept of public libraries come over with the original European immigrants, or was the concept conceived in America?
Before 1850, and I'm pulling a date out of history, you don't consider it exact. Before 1850, there were a number of libraries in the United States that were called public libraries. But the definition of public at that time was any library to which any member of the public had access. Thus, if I owned a private library, my own library, and Chuck would come to me and say, can I use your library to check this one thing? And I said, yes, my library would be called a public library. Now, it wasn't until Boston sat down, and these were what are called Boston Bremerns, the elite in Boston, sat down, and admittedly, they were worried about these ignorant Irish Americans flooding the shores of North America and hanging around in Boston, and they worried that this citizenry, if they became citizens, would vote the wrong way. So if they had this institution, a free public library, they would naturally be led to good books and become informed citizens and vote the correct way. Okay? All right. So that was a motivating factor. At the same time, however, they were altruistic people, and they believed that a free public library was in the best interests of their community. So they established it. And you know what happened? They had the best books there, and people came in, and 75% of the circulation was the fiction that was put there just to get them in the door. And, my goodness, over the years, that percentage stayed the same all the way through the end of the 19th century. Now, I got plenty of anecdotes to show what people were getting from that fiction that the Boston Public Library trustees and managers were unaware of. They were railing against Oliver Optic and Horatio Alger, just like most other cultural authorities were. So the concept of public library as we experience it in the United States is something that evolved within our midst, but it's been modified significantly over time, and largely, I would say, by the people who used it.
Please join me again. Yep.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. In celebration of National Library Week, April 10th through the 16th, we've heard a talk by Wayne Wigand, renowned American library historian and author, often referred to as the Dean of American Library Historians. Dr. Wigand is the author of Irrepressible Reformer, a biography of Melville Dewey, published in 1996. His topic, which is the same as the title of his latest book, was Part of Our Lives, A People's History of the American Public Library. This program, co-sponsored by the Omaha Public Library, the UNO College of Education, and the UNO Department of English, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, September 23rd, 2015, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Emily Getchman, Marketing Manager with the Omaha Public Library, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.